Thank you, George. It's always very easy to have an assigned subject. And when we announce a subject, if you haven't heard it before, there'll be many of you that have heard one version or other of it. Just about a year ago in the program back at Summer Task Force in Washington, a certain phase of it was being concluded, and we had an evangelistic meeting where I believe that most of the people in the training program were bringing some of those with whom they worked. This happened to be the night that the first moon landing was to take place. And so I spent part of the day putting some of the things together that I'd accumulated over the years on space exploration and the greatness of God. So we practiced that night. And then a few other places since in the past year, and we've had some dummy runs, and this is the real message tonight. All these others were just rehearsals. So if there are some of you that have heard this real recently, why, please prompt me if I make an error as it's being delivered, okay? When we talk about the greatness of God, we know that at the best it is only a partial effort, because we're told in Psalm 145 verse 3 that His greatness is unsearchable. It cannot be searched out. But we will try to bring out just two parts of His greatness this evening. One is the greatness of His person, and the second, the greatness of His interest in you. I believe that almost everyone's interest in space was greatly heightened after the moon landing took place just a little less than a year ago, last July. And anticipating that it was going to be a success, I tried to anticipate what some of the newspaper editors were going to say about this landing. And my anticipation was that they would say that space travel is now a reality. And sure enough, the morning paper said, now space travel has really begun. If you were making a round-the-world trip, starting here at Glen Eyrie, and stopped down Colorado Springs for gas, and the place where you put gasoline in your car was the person knew you was on a round-the-world trip. And he said, how's your round-the-world trip coming? And you said, well, I'm well on my way. I don't think he would be greatly impressed. If you were going to make a space trip from the Earth to Pluto, which is the outermost planet in our solar system, when you reach the moon, you would be the same proportional distance to Pluto as you would be on a round-the-world trip when you arrived at a spot 3 miles from where you started on Glen Eyrie. And when travel out into the real reaches of space has begun, for a person to have reached Pluto and to say that he's embarked on space travel will be about as realistic as for you to say, I'm going around the world, I've arrived at the front door, and I'm well on my way. What we're trying to point out, that there is a lot of space and a great many bodies out in that space. Up until a few hundred years ago, it was believed that there were 1,014 stars. But a long time before that number was arrived at, over in Genesis 15:5, God asked Abraham one day, challenged him to count the number of them. And, of course, Abraham could not do that. There are now known to be more than 100 billion stars in the galaxy of which we are a part. And there has been discovered more than 100,000 additional galaxies similar to ours. The closest star to us is our sun. Now, if you were able to take off from some place in this state on a rocket ship that could travel at 1,000,000 miles an hour, how long would it take you to get to the sun? 1,000,000 miles an hour. How long? 1,000,000 miles an hour. Okay, about 93 hours, about 4 days to get there. Now, if that same rocket ship traveling at 1,000,000 miles an hour were going to stop also at the next closest star, Alpha Centauri, how long do you suppose it'd be to the next stop? 4 days to the first one? 3,000 years to the next one. And then, if you just picked out the string, the next closest, the average distance between each one of them would be that same amount, about 3,000 years at 1,000,000 miles per hour. So what we're suggesting is that there's a lot of space, and there are a lot of heavenly bodies out in that space. My wife told me once about a young man and young woman who were sitting out under the stars one night, and to keep the conversation going, she said, "Aren't they multitudinous?" And he said, "Yeah, and there's a lot of them too."
Hey, how come some of them didn't laugh, Jim?
Well, I'll since you're not very romantic, I'll try another here, George. You know, when moon travel began, I tried to think back in what I'd learned about the moon, and the first thing I was surprised was that the reporters came out and said that our astronauts, when they circled around the moon a year ago last Christmas, were the first people who had been behind it. Now, that doesn't agree with what I learned in the first grade, and that was about that wild party, the end of which the cow jumped over the moon. And astronomers say that the Milky Way is the proof that that actually happened. But in trying to think out how the moon affected us practically, having spent a great deal of my life at sea, I know that we learned that it was the moon that affected the tide. But somebody told me that in other than navigator circles, that the moon affects the untide even more than the tide.
You're okay, Jim.
It affects the tide also. Good. Well, well, we were talking a while ago about the vastness of space and the great number of stars out there. Now we come to Psalm 147, verse 4, which tells us, "He telleth the number of the stars." God knows the number of them. But that isn't the only number that he knows. Over in Matthew chapter 10, verses 29 and 30, one day as Christ was talking about the worth of the individual, he gave an illustration from the supermarket of the day. And they had bargain sales, even those days. So in Matthew 10:29, he talked about the going price of sparrows down in the market. And he said, "Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing?" Two for a farthing. Now I'd like to look at Luke 12:6 to check your mathematics here, as he was talking about what it was like on the day there was a special. He kept up with these things, and in Luke 12:6 he said, "Are not five sparrows sold for two farthings?" Now let's see how good your mathematics is this time of night. What's the bargain? How many for one farthing?
Two.
How many for two farthings?
Five.
So the fifth one was just thrown in free. Of very little value. Christ said in Matthew 10:31, "Fear not, ye are of more value than many sparrows." In verse 28, he said, verse 29, "Not one of them shall fall to the ground without your Father's knowledge." And then to press home his point, he said, "The very hairs of your head are all numbered." God knows the number of the stars, and he knows the number of the hairs in your head. And he's had to revise his records every time most of us have combed our hair today. But that isn't all. In this same verse, Psalm 147:4, we're told he calls them all by their names. He knows the number, and he knows the names. And he knows your name also. It's been very interesting to me to observe in Scripture how conscious and aware God is of everybody's name. I checked this the other day in Samuel, at Samuel's call. And when God got ready to speak to him, he didn't say, "Hey, boy, Samuel, Samuel," every time. One day when Gideon was getting ready to take one of his fellow officers on a reconnaissance tour, God didn't say, "Get that tall, skinny one over there." He says, "You take Urah." He knew everybody in that army and knew just who he wanted to go with him. And then you remember, Mary thought, as she heard footsteps behind her, that it was a gardener. And then Jesus said to her, "Mary." And she knew that the gardener didn't know her name. She knew it had to be. He knows your name. But that isn't all. Over in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 17, we're told, "To him that overcometh, I will give a new name." And furthermore, he says, "A new name which no man knoweth, saving he that receiveth it." So God not only knows the name you have now, but he has reserved to reveal to every one of us one day a new name. So when we're walking around heaven during eternity and we hear that name, we'll know two things. We'll know who it is that spoke it, and we'll know that there's nobody else within hearing, because he will never use that name for anybody but us. Now, I don't know where this fits in, but, I just fit it anyway, even though it doesn't. I heard about the fellow visiting the penitentiary once, and he saw the fellow had two numbers. And he said, "What's that other number for?" And he said, "That was his nick number." So he had two numbers. But God doesn't have a number for you. He knows your present name, and he has a new name, not a number. I was watching a panel show of some kind on TV several years ago, and the MC asked the ladies on the panel, he asked one of them, he said, "Does your husband have a special name for you that he never uses, except between the two of them? And nobody else has ever heard that but you?" She got real embarrassed, as if to say, "Who's been bugging our home?" And she said, "Yes, he does." The MC said, "What is it?" She hesitated for a moment. She says, "I'm not going to tell you. That's our secret." So that's one of the secrets that we're going to share with our Lord throughout eternity, the new name that he's been given. So to review, God knows the number of the stars. He knows the number of the hairs in our head. God knows the name of the stars. He knows our present name and our new name. But that isn't all. Over in 1 Corinthians 15:41, we're told that every star differs from every other star in glory. We have a hint over in Job 38:7 as to what this is talking about. As we're told that during the original creation, that all the stars sang and made music together. There's a suggestion that every star is a sort of electronic organ, and each contributes a different set of notes to the greatest symphony that's ever been put together. And no wonder that there's so many people today who can't work without a background of stereo. Well, Adam had it. Quite a stereo. And it's still playing out there. Sin has dulled our audio frequency so that it doesn't come in. There's been a couple of articles in Reader's Digest recently on the stars and on radio astronomy. I reviewed these articles the other day, and this astronomer pointed out that radio astronomers are discovering intelligent signals coming from the stars in outer space at the rate of 5 new ones per month that have a frequency from which they never vary. Well, I fully expect that the next discovery that's going to be made by the radio astronomers is how to computerize these signals, play them into a transmitter, and come out with music, the like of which has never been heard. So God knows the name of the stars, He knows the number, and He knows the purpose for which every one of them was created. I heard about a high school band that was giving their first performance. One of the fellows had forgot to bring his program, but he thought he remembered pretty well what the order of events was. But about halfway through, he got a little insecure. He turned the fellow next to him, and he said, "What's our next number?" And he said, "Star Spangled Banner." He said, "I just played that." Now, if you have heard a high school band giving their first performance, you can understand how this could happen. And the reason some of these happen is that some people are not playing the right note at the right time.
You can say that.
I believe in putting these ideas together. 1 Corinthians 15:41. Actually, when he talks about every star being different from every other star, he's using this as an illustration how that every person is different from every other person. For the past several months, I've just had one message, and no matter what the situation is, I always bring it in. And that is the biblical importance of everybody doing His thing. God knows the purpose for which He created you, and He created me. And there will never be harmony and effectiveness in the body of Christ until every one of us is doing His thing. I hope you never dishonor God by thinking if you were someone else or like someone else, you can serve Him better than the person you are. I'm going to talk about some big numbers in a minute. I guess now is as good a time as any. Over in Genesis 22, when God was reaffirming to Abraham what He was going to do in and through him, and He talked about the multiplication of his seed, He said it was going to be multiplied not only like the stars, but, this is Genesis 22:17, the sand which is upon the seashore. Several years ago, an astronomer attempted to estimate the number of stars in the universe. And the number he came up with was 10 to the 28th power. A few years later, Sir James Jeans, the British scientist, thought he'd figure out how many grains of sand there were on all the seashores of the world. And unstrangely enough, he came up with the same figure, 10 to the 28th power. Does God know any number greater than 10 to the 28th power? In Psalm 139, verses 17 and 18, he said, "How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God? How great is the sum of them! If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand." So if there are 10 to the 28th power grains of sand on all the beaches, God has passed through his mind more than that number of thoughts about you. On one occasion, while our astronauts were out in space, they read from Psalm 8:3, where the psalmist was saying, "When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him?" Now we've got an answer to that tonight, because I've been told if you were to multiply the average size human being to where he would be the size of the greatest object out in space that's ever been measured, and I believe that that is the star Epsilon Eriugae, which is 1,800,000,000 miles in diameter, you could put our whole solar system inside of that one star. The multiplication to make a man from an average size to that side would require the multiplication of 10 to the 28th power. And we've been told if the average size man were reduced to the smallest object that's ever been measured, the reduction would be 1 over 10 to the 28th power. What is man that thou art mindful of him? Man seems to be the focal point of God's interest and attention, the exact center between the infinitely large and the infinitely small. A college freshman came home during his first vacation. He'd been studying astronomy. He talked to his pastor. He said, "You know, when I see the vastness of the universe, I just can't believe that God could be interested in me. Do you have a suggestion?" The pastor did have a suggestion. He said, "Next semester, take a course that requires the use of the microscope, and you'll find God in the infinitely small as well as in the infinitely large." Now to review, God, oh, one other thing here about you. I was talking about some of these things down in New Zealand recently. One of the fellows who had been studying genetics, he said, "You know, that's genetically true, that God made everybody different." And he says the genetic possibilities before God has to duplicate is 3 billion to the 30th power. There are that many genetic possibilities. God hasn't used all of them yet. He made everybody different. God knows the number of the stars, the number of hairs in your head. He knows the names. He knows your name and your new name. God knows the purpose for which he created every star, and he knows the purpose for which he created you. And he knows that why he put together that particular formula of genes and chromosomes that made you what you are physically, mentally, and in every way. But that isn't all. Over in Isaiah 45:12, we're told that not only, I want to read that verse completely. Now, it interests me that most of the great men of our age, as well as other ages, decline to be quoted directly. But when God used to talk through these Old Testament prophets, he always said, and you can quote me on this direct. So in Isaiah 45, 12, we have one of the quotes. God said, I have made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens, and all their host have I commanded. Not only did I make them, but I command them. Now, to get a little insight into what this means, let me tell you a story. One day, one of my sons asked me the question. He said, if God is as real as some of you folks maintain, why doesn't he just show himself the way he did in the Old Testament? And that would relieve all doubt. So I said to him, I said, David, what time is it? He looked at his watch. I said, is that the correct time? He said, yes. I said, how do you know? He said, well, I dialed that number, you know, down the telephone office and listened to the recording. I said, how did they know that was the correct time? He said, well, I don't know. Well, I said, well, I will enlighten you. Several years ago, the Congress of the United States gave the responsibility for furnishing the correct time to the United States as well as to all these ships at sea. So in the northwest part of Washington, D.C., those of you who have lived there and visited there know that there's the great Naval Observatory. In the Naval Observatory, they have the finest telescopes and finest chronometers that men and money can put together. So the situation is similar to this. Every morning, during the night too, they focus certain telescopes on certain stars. And when this star reaches a certain position in the telescope, they say, mark, and they check the time. If the time does not agree with their tables, they never say, Venus is a microsecond ahead this morning. They say, correct the chronometer. Because man uses as a reference point for time the movement of the stars. God said, all their host have I commanded. And in measuring them, they've never varied a millionth of a second since the time the first records have been kept. Why doesn't God show himself? Psalm 19 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. And God himself, over in the first chapter of Romans, says that those who do not believe are without excuse. Romans 1, 20, 19 and 20, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. Now I'm going to give another reason when we come to a conclusion here in a few minutes of why God does not and cannot manifest himself. Another answer. We're going to come to that a little bit later. Now, as we consider these things we've been talking about, God knows the number, the name, the purpose, and the exact millionth of a second where every one of them is supposed to be at every instant of time. As we consider these things, I think we are like Nicodemus, and we want to ask the question that he asked in John 3:9, how can these things be? And we're going to attempt to throw some light on that question. How can these things be? Week before last, we had as one of our conferees a neurosurgeon, world-famous neurosurgeon. Actually, he'd brought some high school kids out. But some of us had some sessions with him. He is pioneering the research on using sonar to do that which X-ray cannot do. And he said that as a result of his research, that sonar will largely replace X-ray in the days to come. Well, knowing he was an expert on the human brain, I had a real good chance to bounce some of these things we've been thinking about off his brain. So I said, I've heard that the human brain is relatively undeveloped. Is that true? And he said, well, what do you mean? He said that it takes about a third of the brain just to carry on the physical functions. I said, no, I'm talking about the intellect. And he said, well, that's true, that there's large areas that are totally undeveloped. He said that the largest computer with which I've worked had 20,000 vacuum tubes, and it is able to retain information on 4,000 separate operations. He says the human brain can retain 10 to the 23rd power number of separate operations. We've been told that to build a computer which would duplicate the work of the human brain would take 1 billion watts of electricity just to warm it up. It would require 10 billion electronic cells just to store the things that the human brain can store by memory. It would require a building the size of the Empire State Building in which to house it. And the noted doctor confirmed this. Man's brain is less than 2% developed. A neurosurgeon can put the brain of a moron and the brain of a genius on the operating table, and by inspection, he cannot tell the difference. Both are so relatively undeveloped. Now, the point we're trying to make is, even in its undeveloped state, that the human brain is quite a remarkable organ. Now, in order to draw the comparison I want to draw, I'm going to kind of go into what you will think is almost fantasy, but we'll be back and get our feet on the ground. Several years ago, I got acquainted with a family up in the Northwest who had had an unusual experience. One day, while going to a meeting, father, wife, and daughter, husband, wife, and daughter, they turned a corner too fast, car tipped over, and landed on the husband's chest. Some people came along, lifted the car off, but by the time they got it off, the husband had stopped breathing. Now the lady was very spiritual and very practical. She said, Lord, we were on our way to a meeting. The people are there. My husband had his message ready. I just can't believe this is what you wanted. So I just pray that you will start him breathing again so we can get on the meeting. And he did. And went on and conducted the meeting. Later he wrote down some of the things that he had experienced during that time. He said one of the most remarkable things was that although he knew he was absent from his physical body, he had a right arm and a left arm and a right ear and a left ear and a right eye and a left eye. He had a different body that had every attribute that his body had had, his physical body had had. Now, that is not unscriptural. 2 Corinthians 5:1 tells us that when we leave this body, we have a building of God, a building not made with hands, eternal in the heavens, waiting for us, so that we will not be found naked. When a person leaves this body, we are not disembodied spirits. The oven is waiting. Now, I think as you study the account of the rich man and Lazarus over in Luke 16, we can draw some very interesting observations from that. One would be that almost instantly after death, here is the rich man and Lazarus. Now, if you'd gone out to the cemetery at the same time after Christ had told this story and dug up the grave of the rich man and Lazarus, I'm sure you'd have found their body and bones down there. Now, what gives? here's their old body and bones down here, and here's their new body. And it looks so much like the old one that nobody can tell the difference. Well, I kind of stored this away in one of the 10 billion electronic cells in my brain. A few years later, over at the Pink House, at a meal, I was sitting next to Dr. Edmond, who at that time was the president of Wheaton College. I knew from having read some of the things he'd written that while he was a missionary in South America, he had been stricken with a tropical disease. It was fatal, supposedly. Mrs. Edmond dyed her wedding dress black. They ordered a coffin and set a time for the funeral service, because down there was a requirement, I understand, George, you can tell me if I'm wrong, that for sanitary purposes, the body had to be buried within 4 hours after death occurred. So they got all set up, including having the time of the service set and the coffin outside the bedroom. But the doctors never could quite pronounce him dead, because they'd find a flicker of life one time and none the next time. And this went on for several days. Well, you know that eventually Dr. Edmond recovered and went on to have many useful years of service. Well, I thought there's no opportunity like the present. I was sitting next to him. There were just three or four of us at the table. I said, Dr. Edmond, I read over in 2 Corinthians about Paul being caught up to the third heaven. And many Bible scholars believe that the experience he is relating corresponds to when he was stoned and left for dead outside Lystra. Now, Paul said the things that he saw and heard were not lawful for him to repeat. I said, Dr. Edmond, do you feel that way about it? Or do you? Would you tell me some of the things that you went through? He said, the things that I experienced, some of them were so sacred and personal, I have never even told them in my own life. And I never will. And the subject was about to be closed. But I told him about this fellow up in Washington. I said, now, did you have the sensation of a right arm, a left arm, and a right eye and a left eye and all that? He said, well, come to think about it. He said, I did. But he said, that's not what impressed me. He said, you know, I have an inquiring mind, and there's a lot of things, problems, to which I have no solutions. But he said, the minute I would get in that other body, the solution to every problem I'd ever had was so clear. I said, how did I miss it? Just that clear. Well, I thought that was amazing. And then he said, but that's not what really impressed me. He said, my emotions were so intense, it is absolutely unbelievable. He said, I thought I had the capacity to love God and to enjoy Him and to love people and to hate sin. But he said, I found out I really didn't. He said, the intensity of my emotions was unbelievable and unspeakable. Now, why are we mentioning this? One of these days, God's going to give us a real brain, one that works, and a real heart, and a real body. But even then, we're not going to have God's brain and His heart. How can these things be? I hope this gives a little insight into the greatness of God's mind and God's heart. I firmly believe that it's just as easy for God to know the number of the stars and the number of hairs in your head and your name and your new name and the star's purpose and your purpose and what the schedule for every one of them is, as it is for me to know how many children I have and their names. I know that. I don't know much, but I know that. It's just as easy for God to know. Last March, we spent a weekend up in the Northwest, and the fellows asked me if I was game for a floor meeting over at the dormitory. And I said, sure, I don't have to pick up the pieces. I'll go over, because I'm going to leave town after it's over. So they said, how shall we advertise you? And they gave some suggestions and then made the decision without ever asking me again. And they billed me as an expert on the life of Christ. So we got out. They came out of the walls, all these creatures. About 35 or 40 of them. And we had a real good evening. We had planned the meeting for 30 minutes, but it didn't even slack off for an hour and 5 minutes. And the first lull was an hour and 5 minutes, and we had a couple hours later. But during the course of the discussion, one fellow said to me, he said, I don't know what your idea of a real kick is, but he said, floating around on a cloud waving a halo isn't very challenging to me. And then I told him the story that I've just told you about Dr. Edmund. And I said, now, I haven't checked the curriculum, but I believe that if you would take all the courses that the University of Washington offers, it would take 75 years for you to graduate. Now, I said, one of these days, God is going to give me a real brain, and I'm going to graduate from the University of Washington. Everything that's taught. And I may do it in an afternoon. And then I said to him, God has placed within your body an eternal spirit, and it has eternal aspirations and appetites and desires and ambitions. The brain that you've got because of sin and the heart you've got is about as effective for expressing the aspirations of that eternal soul as a burned out resistor in a radio. Now I said to him, you know, talk about kicks. I agree with you. Flying around on a cloud waving a halo doesn't challenge me much either. But enjoying all that God has made with a real heart and a real brain and a real body is my idea of really living. So you see, I had an opportunity to bring in the gospel. Now to shift for a little bit. Earlier we talked about the problem of the vastness of space. You see, if David, instead of going in the grave, had gotten on this spaceship going a million miles an hour at his death, he would just be arriving at Alpha Centauri about now. The distances are pretty great. Many of you, I know, have seen the Moody Institute of Science films and know that Dr. Irwin Moon is the producer of the Moody Institute of Science films. What you may not know is that the navigators have had a close tie with Irwin Moon since the very beginning. In fact, when Dawson and Lila Trotman were first married, they couldn't find an apartment, so they lived with Irwin and Margaret Moon for the first 3 months of their married life. In the early days, all the fellows with whom I was associated used to attend the church where Irwin Moon is a pastor. He started out, after going through Bible school, as a pastor of the Montecito Union Church in Los Angeles. We had many intimate conversations with him during the days of his putting things together. In fact, the first full week of meetings that Irwin Moon ever held were sponsored by the navigators, because he wasn't well enough known to bring a crowd, and the navigators were. So we set him up. The first time he held five consecutive meetings. He used to just do one-night stands. But he got enough together for five nights, and so we sponsored him. One day, a small group of us was talking with him, and he told us about a conversation he had had. He didn't name the person, but we were very sure that it was Dr. Robert Millikan, who at that time was the president of Caltech. Irwin asked Dr. Millikan, I'm going to assume it was he, if he believed in God. Dr. Millikan said, oh yes, I do. In fact, everybody that I know, all the scientists that I do, believe in God. The closer we get to the basic construction of matter, the more we know there has to be a God. But he said, don't get me wrong, I don't believe the way that you do. And Irwin asked him what the difference was. He said, well, let me ask you a question. Where is heaven located? Irwin said, well, we used to say it was up, but now we know the world is round with respect, so, you know, we give the Chinese a chance. We say that it's out instead of up. So Dr. Millikan said, how far out? And Irwin says, well, I don't know. He then asked the question, is Abel in heaven? Irwin Moon said, yes, Abel is in heaven. Dr. Millikan said, how did he get there? Dr. Moon said, I don't know. Dr. Millikan said, if heaven is located just beyond the range of my telescope, and Abel has been traveling at the speed of light for 6,000 years, he is only one-third the distance that I've seen with my telescope. So, assuming that heaven is just beyond the range of my telescope, he has 12,000 years to go at the speed of light. Now, you've probably figured out that the speed of light is such that if you were to fire a pistol that had the capability of firing the bullet in a trajectory around the Earth, if I fired it and didn't move, there would be 7 holes through me 1 second from the time it started. A bullet traveling at the speed of light will go around the Earth 7 times a second. Now here, he said, he's been traveling that fast for 6,000 years. He's got 12,000 to go. Now, how would you like to be in a personal evangelism situation like this? But I'm sure the Lord gave Irwin wisdom. And he said, Dr. Millikan, you have received the Nobel Prize for your work in physics, which led to the splitting of the atom. You have done more than any other person to popularize the idea of the porosity of matter. Now, if what you maintain is true, is this wall mostly space? Dr. Millikan said, it's about as porous as a breath of fresh air. He said, if the wall is porous and this chair is porous, why can't I push the chair through the wall? In the same way that I can push my fingers through one another. Now, to you sharp new students that would rather talk about the quantum theory than the atomic theory, we could do that, but the illustration's the same. It doesn't change the illustration to be thinking about the quantum theory instead of the other. Dr. Millikan says, I don't know why you can't push the chair through the wall. He said, I've tried it. It won't go through. That I know. But he said this, I'll tell you. It is not because there is a collision of the solid particles, because that doesn't happen. He said, we assume that between the solid particles, there is an electrical flux. There are opposing frequencies that keeps it from going through. Now, if you want to illustrate this, the next time you've got two horseshoe magnets, try to push them together. Like pulled against like. And you will find that there's a strong invisible force that keeps you from doing it. That's what Dr. Millikan was talking about. Irwin Moon said, if this theory is true, would it be possible for two Earths to occupy the same space at the same time and neither be conscious of the other's existence if they were perfectly synchronized so there was no collision? Dr. Millikan thought for a minute, and he said, yes. Not only two, but hundreds of thousands. Irwin said, you know, I think I've learned something very valuable from this conversation, because I was reading in Ephesians 2:6 this morning that we are seated in heavenly places in Christ Jesus. He said, you know, to get to heaven, I may not have to move an inch. All I have to do is change to a different frequency. And Erwin Moon went on to tell us, when Colossians 1:27 says that Christ is in you, don't spiritualize that away. It is literally true. And I think Matthew 18:19 is true also. When two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. No wonder that God made Jeremiah say in Jeremiah 23:23, am I a God at hand, saith the Lord, and not a God afar off? I'm a God at hand. Psalm 34:7 tells us, the angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. I have never seen an angel. To the best of my knowledge, I've never heard one speak. And also, to the best of my knowledge, I've never collided with one. But I believe that the world is full of them. In fact, my wife and I think that without the help of a guardian angel, not a one of our children would have ever grown to maturity. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him, but I haven't seen them. Well, where are they? 2 Kings chapter 6 gives us the answer. You know, this is like reading the morning paper. Israel and Syria were fighting. And the Syrians, as usual, had the larger army. Today, there are 2.8 million Jews, 115 million Arabs around them. The proportion was similar in that day. So the Arabs, the Syrians, kept setting up roadblocks to wipe out the reconnaissance patrols. And every time that a patrol would come to the roadblock, they'd go right around it, go on their way. This happened so many times that the commander-in-chief, the king of Syria, said that the only way they can do that is somebody's tipped them off where we're setting up the roadblock. So he began to narrow down the information. It still happened. So one day he called just his staff together. He said, the purpose of this meeting is to find out which one of us is a traitor that's feeding information to the king of Israel. And then there was a heavy silence. Then one of the fellows spoke up. And he said to the king, it's none of us. This is verse 12, 2 Kings 6:12. And one of his servants said, none, O Lord, my Lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet that is in Israel, telleth the king of Israel the words that thou speakest in thy bedchamber. Not only does the king of Israel get a full report on our staff meetings, but he gets a full report on what you say in your sleep. Well, the king of Syria wisely said, where's Elisha? We've got to get him. He's down at Dothan. That's down in Alabama, isn't it, John? So, they sent out an army that night and surrounded Dothan. The next morning, Elisha and the young man that he was working man-to-man with went out to have a quiet time. And the young man was a little distracted because all he could see was soldiers heavily armed in every direction. So he just couldn't have a quiet time. And he said to Elisha, alas, my master, verse 15, how shall we do? Elisha said, fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. Now, I think the young man had a great deal of respect for Elisha's spirituality, but not too much for his mathematics, which is often true of people in Christian work. And he said, they that be with us are more than they that be with them. Well, the young man didn't get it. Elisha saw that he didn't. So he said, and Elisha prayed and said, this is verse 17, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. Now, if we were to translate that into the language of our day, I think we'd say, change frequencies so he can see what's out there. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, changed the frequency, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. I don't think Elisha ever saw them, but he knew they were there. But God just changed the frequency, and this young man saw into the unseen world. There's a thin veil separating the seen and the unseen. I don't think Stephen had an extraordinary eyesight, but as he was being martyred, he said, I see the heavens open, and Jesus standing at the right hand of the throne of God. Where is heaven? You know, I think there's scriptural evidence that not only is man the focal point of God's interest, but it may be that his headquarters is located in the same part of space that the earth's in, but just on a different frequency. Now I want to bring this to a conclusion. I said earlier, why doesn't God show himself? In Hebrews 10:31, we read, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And that's followed up by Hebrews 12:29. For our God is a consuming flame. The frequency on which God operates may be called holiness. Because of what sin has done and is, there's great friction between the house we live in and the frequency on which God operates. For a human being to come into the presence of God would be nothing less than electrocution. The friction between sin and holiness would destroy us. God, in his great mercy, keeps at a distance so that we won't be consumed, as we read about. But one day, when we get in our new body with the new brain and the new heart on a sinless frequency, we'll operate in the same realm that he operates in. Well, these are a few thoughts on the greatness of space and the greatness of God in his person and in his interest in you and me. Now, I know that many think the verse is out of context to quote it like this, but it isn't out of context to me. 1 Corinthians 2:9, eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which the Lord hath prepared for them that love him. We've got a great life and a far greater future. We just can't even comprehend the things that are in store for those of us who are Christians.